You've reached the podcast. Ron and Ken are completely out of it, but you can leave us a message after the beep.
Good morning, Ron and Ken. It's Ginny Thomas. I just wanted to reach across the airwaves and the years and ask you to consider something. I would love you to consider an apology sometime and some full explanation of this podcast.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And sitting across from Ron Elving in the same room, which is very rare, and I'm Ken Rudin.
I'm so thrilled to have you back here in Washington, Ken, and it's just good to have you back and doing the podcast face-to-face, as we used to say.
And I think it's time that we apologize for every podcast we've ever done.
Yes, I do think that the suggestion that was made that we should apologize for the podcast probably was a good suggestion.
There are actually a lot of people this week in the political sphere who should be apologizing.
I think we should start with whoever it was who first told us about the Aqua Buddha.
Do-do-do-do-do-do.
That would be Jethro Tull.
That's Aqua Lung. I'm sorry.
A little 70s humor there for the listener. Here's the thing that's really weird about this. It's been out, of course, for months.
Right.
It came out in GQ magazine.
Congressional Quarterly.
And it came out way back, and there was a little murmur about it at the time. And so the Kentucky Senate race had already taken this rather stunning turn where the establishment candidate, Trey Grayson.
Very Grayson in French.
Had been defeated. And Rand Paul was suddenly the darling, really, of the Tea Party movement. Now, many more darlings have come along since. But
like
at
me.
The time, he was the darling. And we learned about the Aqua Buddha. Now, Ken, explain to us exactly how, in terms of the various forms of Buddhism, the Aqua Buddha fits in.
According to this anonymous source, that Rand Paul was part of this secret society where he tied up a woman or...
Well, he supposedly took her against her will to the place by the river where they worshipped the Aqua Buddha. This has every
made
earmark.
Made her take bong hits.
Look, this has every earmark of college prank,
right.
Of fraternity boys coming up with goofy stuff. It was not, I suspect, in the slightest way a serious attempt at some sort of strange religious rite. It was just college boys goofing off. But when you give the details, as I suspect would be true of the details of some things that you may have done in college, Ken, had you gone to college, this looks bad.
I was in discotheque. So there are two waves of thought. The Conway, obviously Jack Conway, the Democratic nominee, who brought this up in a debate and is now running a commercial in Kentucky talking about this.
Why was Rand Paul a member of a secret society that called the Holy Bible a hoax that was banned for mocking Christianity and Christ? Why did Rand Paul once tie a woman up, tell her to bow down before a false idol, and say his god was Aqua Buddha? Why does Rand Paul now want to end all federal faith-based initiatives and even end the deduction for religious charities? Why are there so many questions about Rand Paul?
It's trying to make the point that, look, Rand Paul is out there and he's just done some weird things and he may be too extreme for Kentucky, whereas Rand Paul has made the case that this is attacking my religion, attacking my faith, and how dare you say that I'm anti-Christian? I am a pro-life Christian and that's what I'm running on, and you're attacking my family, and you're attacking my faith.
Jack, you should be ashamed of yourself. You should apologize. Have you no decency? Have you no shame?
And so what's interesting is that, like, a lot of Democrats have kind of agreed with Rand Paul on this. Claire McCaskill, a senator from Missouri, Democrat, who was on MSNBC, said that she thought that Jack Conway came pretty close to crossing the line.
Yeah, I think you'd have to say this was crossing the line, because it's extraordinarily difficult to imagine that Jack Conway doesn't know exactly what this was all about way back when at Baylor, and that this is not, in a very real sense, a desperate attempt to change the dynamic of the campaign. So, because nothing else has. I mean, whatever else Rand Paul has said about Social Security and Medicare and other popular programs.
The 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Nothing has moved a fairly substantial 5 to 10 point lead in all the polls. And so Conway decided, well, I'll tell you what, let's throw in this hand grenade from this GQ article earlier this year and see how that messes things up. Has it changed the dynamic in the race? In other words, is he going to be in some sense rewarded for this behavior?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there is some indication, and I think we've seen this with a bunch of races, that it has narrowed. As we've seen in the Pennsylvania Senate race, it seems like the Kentucky race has narrowed, still with Rand Paul with a lead, but it has certainly changed the conversation of the debate, and if ultimately, if this is what it's going to be remembered for, then maybe Conway's cause was not helped by this.
No, and on the other hand, I mean, the lesson that will be taken if the race closes up at this point is not the same lesson that would be taken in Pennsylvania, where it appears that Joe Sestak, the Democratic candidate, is finally getting some traction for some of his issues.
Michael Bennett in Colorado.
Michael
as well.
Bennett in Colorado, right. The same thing. Closer. And we'll get to Alaska and Delaware in a moment. But in Kentucky, there doesn't seem to be any other explanation other than he has raised some kind of fundamental questions about whether or not Rand Paul is a mainstream Christian and whether or not he is a, if you will, normal person for Kentucky or the person that he represents himself to be.
Well, and that's the thing. I think it's one thing to say whether you're mainstream or not, but when you start talking about mainstream Christians, then you have Rand Paul given the softball opportunity to say, look, you're attacking my faith, and that's beyond the pale.
Yes. Now, in Alaska, Joe Miller was the Tea Party darling who defeated Lisa Murkowski in the Republican primary there and seemed to have ended her career. Then she decided to come back and run as a write-in. We've talked about the inherent difficulties of that. Only one person having ever been successful in such a campaign for the Senate, that being
Strom Thurmond, 1954.
South Carolina. And we don't really expect Lisa Murkowski to bring this thing off, but she has a chance to do so. And the polls have shown that the race has become something of a three-way contest. Mostly, of course, between Lisa and Joe Miller, but the Democrat not entirely out of it. And part of the reason is because Joe Miller has started to send wacky signals.
Absolutely. This is a Republican state. The only time it ever elects a Democrat, until recently, was 1974. The more recent time was 2008, and only because Ted Stevens was under indictment.
In fact, he had been convicted. At that point, the jury had come back with a conviction that was later overturned by the judge. But at that point, he looked like he was convicted.
And he barely lost.
And he barely lost. So that's to a very acceptable Democratic candidate, right, who was very well known and had a famous name, so on. But the candidate in this particular case was much stronger than the Democratic candidate in this instance. The only thing that's really making this a three-way race is people's uncertainty about whether or not Joe Miller might be a little bit over the wall. Well, there was the incident where the guards, the security people that he has, and it's not entirely clear why he has these security people in the first place, took a reporter, a guy who's a local figure.
Perhaps an obnoxious reporter.
Can you imagine an aggressive, obnoxious journalist?
No.
That's just not credible. But
before that, he also made a point of saying, Joe Miller made a point of saying that I will not discuss my private... I mean, basically, he laid down the law with the journalists, you know, covering his campaign, and his numbers have been plummeting since the August primary.
All right. For a variety of reasons, because he does have questions to answer which he refuses to answer, and this one particular obstreperous person from our profession was handcuffed for a period of time by one of the security officers. That doesn't look good. So there's a certain amount of just controversy surrounding Joe Miller.
He thinks that unemployment insurance is unconstitutional or against the Constitution, while his wife took unemployment. I mean, there's a lot of contradictions in his record that people are pointing out. And again, the Joe Miller for Senate, which would look like it was a likely thing after August, is not so likely. The Democratic campaign, Scott McAdams, the mayor of Sitka. Yes, mm-hmm. I know. Mm-hmm. His numbers have shown, basically, that we're talking about a clear three-way race here.
Yes, and in the end, I would imagine that makes it plausible that even as a write-in candidate, Lisa Murkowski could return to the Senate, which would set up a very interesting dynamic with some of her colleagues there who basically excused her from the leadership and backed her opponent, Joe Miller.
But after the primary,
they will take anybody with an R after their name, I'm sure.
One more thing about Alaska. It's one thing to tell pollsters that, yes, I want to write in Lisa Murkowski. It's another thing to go into the voting
booth.
Bring a pencil and spell it. Does Lisa work? Does Murkowski spelled wrong work? Voter intent in a write-in is very crucial. And so those numbers for Lisa Murkowski may not be as strong on November 2nd as they are in October.
Excellent point. What about in Delaware? Now, this is a race which began life as a Mike Castle walkaway. He lost in the primary, as we've discussed many times, to Christine O'Donnell. She has become a national phenomenon, particularly in the blogosphere, because of when she was a younger person saying provocative things on television. And
now she's
in her 40s and saying more politically provocative things, such as, well, there's no separation of church and state, and you can't read that into the First Amendment, at a law school event where a lot of people were guffawing at that.
Please.
You're telling me that the separation of church and state is found in the First Amendment.
Government shall make no establishment of religion.
That's in the First Amendment.
And she then came back and said, well, this is a debatable point. Pat Robertson, presidential candidate in 1988, used to say, there's no separation of church and state in the Constitution. This is not a new argument.
Right. But in fairness to Christine O'Donnell, her argument, I believe, or I could be wrong, but it's my understanding that conservatives say over and over again that those words, separation of church and state, are not found anywhere in the First Amendment.
Not that verb, not that noun of separation, but the no establishment of religion clause is one of the pillars of the Constitution.
Absolutely.
Back to the very first rulings of the very first courts in this country.
Right.
And so that's why the law students were laughing.
The guffaws and the law students, exactly right.
This is a race that continues to occupy way more attention than anyone ever expected Delaware to do in this year. It usually doesn't. And in this particular year, it was supposed to be an absolutely open and shut case. And then it was supposed to be open and shut for the Democrats once Christine O'Donnell had defeated Mike Castle.
I think it is an open and shut case. And I think that with Coons and most polls showing anywhere between 15 and 20 point lead.
Except Rasmussen. And, of course, Rasmussen, as usual, is the outlier.
And what do they have?
They have it down around 10 or 11.
Okay, but the thing is
still substantial.
The thing is, we're still obsessed with the mouthings of Christine O'Donnell. And look, Bill, I understand why Bill Maher likes to do that.
Is it comic relief? Is that all it is?
I think it is.
Is this the one thing that leavens this long, dreary campaign?
Well, but it also shows that if this is the embodiment of Tea Party philosophy, and many voters say, wait, this is beyond the pale, then there is a certain separation of thought between most voters and the Tea Party.
All right, well, how about Sharon Angle then? Let's go out to Nevada, the marquee race, as everybody says. Harry Reid, the maybe not terribly popular among his Democratic colleagues, leader of the Democrats in the Senate. A lot is going to be laid at his door, even if he survives this election. A lot of people are going to look back on this last Congress and say, well, you know, Nancy Pelosi did her part over on the House side, but Harry Reid just couldn't drive the train on the Senate side, especially if he loses. He's going to wind up with a lot of this on top of his head. But let's contemplate Sharon Angle. How much more inside the mainstream is she than Christine O'Donnell?
Well, I think the fact is she has been an elected official. She served in the
briefly
state legislature.
And,
right.
And at the time, people would say, well, this was another one of those votes where it was everybody against Angle.
That's true. That's true. Everybody knew Sharon Angle was because she was the outlier of everybody else in the legislature.
In both parties.
Right, exactly. But the point is she's also seems to have moderated some of her positions, or at least until recently, moderated some of her previous positions. Say, well, I really didn't mean privatization. I really didn't mean, you know, this or that or this. She tried to be more moderate because obviously, unlike Delaware and Christine O'Donnell, Republicans think they can win that Nevada race.
Oh, and they can.
Which is so remarkable given how she's been pilloried
because
and,
Harry Reid is
and
so
ridiculed.
Unpopular.
Right. So she still has a serious chance. And then came this week's comments by Sharon Angle.
You mean where she said to a group of Hispanic children, you all look Asian to me?
I don't know that all of you are Latino. Some of you look a little more Asian to me. I don't know that.
And then she said, you know, a lot of people said that I was the first Asian member of the state legislature, which makes absolutely no sense.
You mean because of her own appearance? Sharon Angle's own appearance?
That's what she said. And we had John Ralston on Talk of the Nation this week, who, you know, the longtime
journalist from Nevada.
Nevada, who said, I have no idea what she's talking about, and neither did anybody else. And it's just so strange that Harry Reid has done everything he can to excite the Hispanic voting population, which is substantial in Nevada, trying to get them to come out for him, and has basically failed. I wonder if this last thing is what ultimately puts him over the top.
Well, either that or backlash against this ad being run by this Virginia group that's out in Nevada running a Spanish language ad telling people don't vote, because
right,
that just, you know, makes people take you for granted. If you want people to pay attention to you, you have to not vote.
No votes. Don't vote this November. This is the only way to send them a clear message. You can no longer take us for granted. Don't vote.
I mean, there's always been accusations of vote suppression by certain tactics, but I've never seen a commercial where they don't vote. Yeah.
Hispanics, people who understand this ad in Spanish, don't vote.
Or
that'll get you some political
clout. Or the other
clout.
One, okay, to make it easier on the polls, because there's so much crowding, white people should vote on November 2nd, Hispanics vote on November 3rd.
Well,
Wednesday.
we have seen flyers, not television ads,
right,
but we've seen flyers that say Republicans should vote on this day and Democrats on another. And there is such a thing as voter suppression. Yes. That is not a myth.
No.
People have practiced this over the years.
But I've never seen a commercial where it basically says, do not vote.
If you understand this ad and speak Spanish. Right. That, I think, is perhaps a new frontier. Wisconsin, do you believe polls that show that one closing up?
I still had it as a toss-up. Ron Johnson, the Tea Party Republican, the multimillionaire self-financing candidate, has had the lead in the polls. And every poll I've seen has him still up. I just think that perhaps maybe Democrats who have been saying, woe is me, that I didn't get the hope and the change that I was promised in 2006 and 2008, they may be coming a little bit back to the fold. I still think it could be a disastrous night for the Democratic Party, especially in the House. But I think Wisconsin is one of those states that have tightened as well.
I think in this particular case, and maybe this is true of Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, some of these other Republican candidates, the enthusiasm for them as being clear-cut alternatives to what was going on in Washington, more clear-cut than the establishment Republicans they ran against in the primaries, certainly more clear-cut than the Democrats who were claiming to be, for some sort of improvement in Washington. Some of them are getting a different kind of scrutiny now that we're inside the two-week bracket on the election. We're down to the last couple of weeks. And in the last fortnight, oftentimes people start to look at the newspaper stories they've been ignoring all year long or the television programs or the television ads and say, oh, he really said that? Or, oh, you mean they're against Social Security or things of that nature? That's one theory as to why all these races close up.
But there's also the theory that with this, a lot of states having early voting, and everybody,
it's too late?
Well, for Democrats, I'm just wondering that.
But don't you think the people who vote early are the people who make up their minds early? I mean, yeah, these are people who made up their minds last year.
But I'm saying if there was a change, if there are some people are changing their mind late in the campaign, the early voting, in theory at least, could benefit the Republican Party.
My guess is, yes, I mean, I do see the theory. And if people are voting on where they were 2-3 weeks ago, the Republicans will have the maximum of their wave. But if they're voting that early, my guess is they're not the sort of people who make up their mind at the last moment.
Right.
And of course, exit polls always show us that a certain number of the people who voted on any given election day made up their minds in the last weekend or the last day or on their way into the polling place, for crying out loud. That group of people, it seems to me, does not vote early. And that group of people usually is not the strong partisan group.
Well, one state that seems to still be having trouble making up their mind is Illinois, with the Senate race, which has become a very ugly Senate race between Republican Mark Kirk, the Democrat Alexei Janulius, the state treasurer, and basically we're hearing it's the liar from Iraq versus the mob banker, and that's basically how the two candidates are portrayed.
Yeah. In the liar from Iraq versus the mob banker, which way do you go?
I know President Obama really, really wants this. Janulius was a protege of Dick Durbin, who may or may not be the next Democratic leader in the Senate, depending on what happens in Nevada. Ultimately, I kind of think that Kirk wins, but the Democrats really, really want this.
Just as a general remark about this whole election, it strikes me, and I think it strikes a lot of other people, as a generally speaking, sweep them out, big broom, whoever is in should go out kind of election. The Democrats are in. They're in big. The Republicans are therefore going to win and win big. And these states are closing up: Pennsylvania, Illinois, Wisconsin, California, Washington. The Democratic candidate's looking a little better, partly because these are Democratic states. They all voted for Obama. They all voted for John Kerry. They all voted for Al Gore. And there is no particular reason to think that a Democrat would not prosper here, except in an election that is clearly running in the other direction. So at this stage, to see it get a little bit closer is only to say that these are blue states, basically.
Before we leave Illinois altogether, the announcement this week that Roland Burris, who has run for mayor of Chicago once before, says he's considering running again. Obviously, they would love to have a serious black candidate run for mayor.
I think there are a few people in the African-American community who would like to be mayor, and I think that there are a lot of people in the community who would like to choose one, get behind him, and promote that person against Rahm Emanuel and against some of the other candidates who are running. But it looks at this point as though it might be coming down to primarily a race between the county sheriff of Cook County.
Thomas Dart, right.
Tom Dart, who is an attractive sort of new style, and he's not an old machine guy, and Rahm, for better or worse, has pretty much inherited the mantle of being the old machine guy, even though he isn't really that close to the
daily candidate. Yeah.
And therefore, there is another lane for somebody to run in, but Louis Gutierrez, the Hispanic congressman from the West Side, had taken himself out.
Okay.
And, my guess is that unless the African-American vote gets consolidated behind somebody pretty strong, they're going to wind up choosing between these other candidates and trying to cut deals on the side. I don't think Roland Burris is that bring us together candidate.
Ron Elving, you talk about your guess with less than 2 weeks to go, control the House and control the Senate.
Yes.
I don't think the Republicans have a shot, really, at taking over the Senate. But right now, I think the House, I don't see the 50-plus seats that a lot of people are talking about.
That's the consensus now.
I know.
The consensus now is 50 seats.
Right.
And a lot of people who are running numeric models that are respectable numeric models by academics who don't have a dog in the fight,
right,
are running 50 to 55. So I think that there's no real reason to question the consensus except to say that it isn't necessarily right. I just can't put out any evidence to say I don't think it's going to be 50. I think it's going to, at the very least, be in the high 40s, and it could go into the high 50s.
We have a lot more to talk about this week's podcast.
And by the way, that is a measure of how many seats net the Republicans capture. All they need is 39 right, in order to become the majority party.
Right, but next week's podcast, I will say that we will be more specific with numbers. Is that correct, Ron Elman?
Yes, we will be. We will be highly specific with numbers.
What's striking about this is whether or not the Democrats survive control of the House. How many Democrats have completely abandoned Nancy Pelosi?
I think that if you're in a certain number of districts, the ones that voted for John McCain, the blue dog districts and so on, to some degree, it was absolutely necessary this time to run away from Nancy Pelosi. You didn't have to say, as some did, Bobby Bright in Alabama and others,
Jim Marshall in Georgia,
I will not vote for her for speaker again. No, some people have actually gone so far as to do that. That's quite rare. That's unusual. But I do think that to some degree you needed to separate yourself if you were in one of those districts. If you're in any kind of urban district or even the standard suburban districts, you probably don't have to do that. But in these rural southern districts or in some place like Montgomery, Alabama, you pretty much have to say, I'm not with her.
Nancy Pelosi announced this week that no matter what happens, she will be running for speaker next year. After the election, and that'll be kind of interesting, especially if they do lose 40 to 50 seats.
It's going to be tough. No, I mean, technically speaking, on organizing day, when they swear them in and they organize the body, each party puts up a candidate for speaker.
We all
know that the majority is going to win, but I think all Nancy Pelosi is saying here is she expects to stay. She expects to be the leader of the Democratic Party. We'll see if that's the way it shakes out. That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
Very good, Ken. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
The last pre-election podcast.
Well, this old house, my children, this old house must be my wife. This old house was home and comfort, has been fought as darn as life. This old house was rang with laughter, this old house heard many shouts. When out trembles in the darkness, and when the lightning walks about.
I ain't gonna need this house no longer, ain't gonna need this house no more.